up. Just say no, I tell him, setting the drinks on the table. That's all you have to say. Just say no? Hamlin smiles. It works? Well, actually, only with pregnant homeless women, I admit. I take it you haven't tried the just-say-no approach with the 7-foot gorilla on Chambers Street, Reeves asks. The one with the crack pipe? Listen, has anyone heard of this club called Nekanaya? Reeves asks. From my POV, Paul Owen sits at a table across the room with someone who looks a lot like Trent Moore, or Roger Daly, and some other guy who looks like Frederick Connell. Moore's grandfather owns the company he works at. Trent is wearing a mini houndstooth check worsted wool suit with multicolored overplaid. Nekanaya? Hamlin asks. What's Nekanaya? Guys, I say. Who's sitting with Paul Owen over there? Is that Trent Moore? Where? Reeves. They're getting up. That table, I say. Those guys. Isn't that Madison? No, it's Dibble, Reeves says. He puts on his clear prescription eyeglasses just to make sure. No, Hamlin says. It's Trent Moore. Are you sure? Reeves asks. Paul Owen stops by our table on his way out. He's wearing sunglasses by Persol and carrying a briefcase by Coach Leatherware. Hello, men, Owen says, and he introduces the two guys he's with, Trent Moore and someone named Paul Denton. Reeves and Hamlin and I shake their hands without standing up. George and Todd start talking to Trent, who is from Los Angeles and knows where Nekanaya is located. Owen turns his attention my way, which makes me slightly nervous. How have you been? Owen asks. Well, I've been great, I say. And you? Oh, terrific, he says. How's the Hawkins account going? I stall and then continue, faltering momentarily. It's all right. Really? He asks, vaguely concerned. That's interesting, he says, smiling, hands clasped together behind his back. Not great? Oh, well, I say, you know. And how's Marcia? He asks, still smiling, looking over the room, not really listening to me. She's a great girl. Oh, yes, I say, shaken. I'm lucky. Owen has mistaken me for Marcus Halberstam, even though Marcus is dating Cecilia Wagner, but for some reason it really doesn't matter, and it seems a logical faux pas, since Marcus works at P&P also, in fact does the same exact thing I do, and he also has a penchant for Valentino suits and clear prescription glasses, and we share the same barber at the same place, the Pierre Hotel, so it seems understandable. It doesn't irk me. But Paul Denton keeps staring at me, or trying not to, as if he knows something, as if he's not quite sure he recognizes me or not, and it makes me wonder if maybe he was on that cruise a long time ago, one night last March. If that's the case, I'm thinking, I should get his telephone number, or better yet, his address. Well, we should have drinks, I tell Owen. Great, he says. Let's. Here's my card. Thanks, I say, looking at it closely, relieved by its crudeness, before slipping it into my jacket. Maybe I'll bring... I pause, then carefully say, Marcia? That would be great, he says. Hey, have you been to that Salvadorian bistro on 83rd? He asks. We're eating there tonight. Yeah, I mean, no, I say, but I've heard it's quite good. I smile weakly and take a sip of my drink. Yes, so have I. He checks his Rolex. Trent? Denton? Let's split. Reservations in 15 minutes. Goodbyes are said, and on their way out of Harry's, they stop by the table Dibble and Hamilton are sitting at, or at least I think it's Dibble and Hamilton. Before they leave, Denton looks over at our table, at me, one last time, and he seems panicked, convinced of something by my presence, as if he recognized me from somewhere, and this, in turn, freaks me out. The Fisher account, Reeves says. Oh, shit, I say, don't remind us. Lucky bastard, Hamlin says. Has anyone seen his girlfriend? Reeves asks. Lori Kennedy? Total hard body. I know her, I say, admit. I knew her. Why do you say it like that? Hamlin asks, intrigued. Why does he say it like that, Reeves? Because he dated her, Reeves says casually. How did you know that? I ask, smiling. Girls dig Bateman. Reeves sounds a little drunk. He's GQ. You're total GQ, Bateman. Thanks, guy. But I can't tell if he's being sarcastic, but it makes me feel proud, in a way, and I try to downplay my good looks by saying, she's got a lousy personality. Oh, Christ, Bateman, Hamlin groans. What does that mean? What? I say. She does. So what? It's all looks. Lori Kennedy is a babe, Hamlin says emphatically. Don't even pretend you were interested for any other reason. If they have a good personality, then something is very wrong, Reeves says, somehow confused by his own statement. If they have a good personality and they are not great-looking, Reeves holds his hands up, signifying something. Who fucking cares? Well, let's just say, hypothetically, okay, what if they have a good personality? I ask, knowing full well what a hopeless, asinine question it is. Fine, hypothetically, even better, but, Hamlin says, I know, I smile. There are no girls with good personalities, we all say in unison, laughing, giving each other high five. A good personality, Reeves begins, consists of a chick who has a little hard body and who will satisfy all sexual demands without being too slutty about things and who will essentially keep her dumb fucking mouth shut. Listen, Hamlin says, nodding in agreement. The only girls with good personalities who are smart or maybe funny or halfway intelligent or even talented, though God knows what the fuck that means, are ugly chicks. Absolutely, Reeves nods. And this is because they have to make up for how fucking unattractive they are, Hamlin says, sitting back in his chair. Well, my theory's always been, I start, men are only here to procreate, to carry on the species, you know? They both nod. And so the only way to do that, I continue, choosing words carefully, is to get turned on by a little hard body, but sometimes money or fame. No buts, Hamlin says, interrupting. Bateman, are you telling me that you're going to make it with Oprah Winfrey? Hey, she's rich, she's powerful. Or go down on Nell Carter? Hey, she's got a show on Broadway, a great voice, residuals pouring in. Wait, Reeves says, who is Nell Carter? I don't know, I say, confused by the name. She owns Nell's, I guess. Listen to me, Bateman, Hamlin says. The only reason chicks exist is to get us turned on, like you said. Survival of the species, right? It's as simple, he lifts an olive out of his drink and pops it into his mouth, as that. After a deliberate pause, I say, do you know what Ed Gein said about women? Ed Gein? One of them asks. Maitre d' at Canal Bar? No, I say. Serial killer, Wisconsin in the 50s. He was an interesting guy. You've always been interested in stuff like that, Bateman, Reeves says, and then to Hamlin. Bateman reads these biographies all the time. Ted Bundy and Son of Sam and Fatal Vision and Charlie Manson. All of them. So what did Ed say? Hamlin asks, interested. He said, I begin, when I see a pretty girl walking down the street, I think two things. One part of me wants to take her out and talk to her and be real nice and sweet and treat her right. I stop, finish my J&B in one swallow. What does the other part of him think? Hamlin asks tentatively. What her head would look like on a stick, I say. Hamlin and Reeves look at each other and then back at me, before I start laughing, and then the two of them uneasily join in. "Listen, what about dinner?" I say, casually changing subjects. "How about that Indian-Californian place on the Upper West Side?" Hamlin suggests. "Fine with me," I say.
"Sounds good," Reeves says.
"Who'll make the res?" Hamlin asks. Deck chairs. Courtney Lawrence invites me out to dinner on Monday night, and the invitation seems vaguely sexual, so I accept. But part of the catch is that we have to endure dinner with two Camden graduates, Scott and Anne Smiley, at a new restaurant they chose on Columbus called Deck Chairs, a place I had my secretary research so thoroughly that she presented me with three alternative menus of what I should order before I left the office today. The things that Courtney told me about Scott and Anne: he works at an advertising agency. She opens restaurants with her father's money, most recently 1968, on the Upper East Side. On the interminable cab ride uptown was only slightly less interesting than hearing about Courtney's day. Facial at Elizabeth Arden, buying kitchen utensils at the Pottery Barn, all of this, by the way, on lithium, before coming down to Harry's, where we had drinks with Charles Murphy and Rusty Webster, and where Courtney forgot the bag of Pottery Barn utensils she'd put underneath our table. The only detail of Scott and Anne's life that seems even remotely suggestive to me is that they adopted a Korean boy of 13 the year after they married, named him Scott Jr., and sent him to Exeter, where Scott had gone to school 4 years before I attended. "They better have reservations," I warned Courtney in the cab.
"Just don't smoke a cigar, Patrick," she says slowly.
"Is that Donald Trump's car?" I ask, looking over at the limousine stuck next to us in gridlock.
"Oh, God, Patrick, shut up,"
she says, her voice thick and drugged. "You know, Courtney, I have a Walkman in my Bottega Veneta briefcase I could easily put on," I say. "You should take some more lithium, or have a Diet Coke. Some caffeine might get you out of this slump."
"I just want to have a child," she says softly, staring out the window to no one. "Just two perfect children."
"Are you talking to me or Shlomo here?" I sigh, but loudly enough for the Israeli driver to hear me, and predictably Courtney doesn't say anything. The Patty Winters show this morning was about perfumes and lipsticks and makeups. Louis Carruthers, Courtney's boyfriend, is out of town in Phoenix and will not be back in Manhattan until late Thursday. Courtney is wearing a wool jacket and vest, a wool jersey t-shirt and wool gabardine pants by Bill Blass, crystal enamel and gold-plated earrings by Gerard E. Yoska, and silk satin d'Orsay pumps from Manolo Blahnik. I am wearing a custom-made tweed jacket, pants and a cotton shirt from the Allen Flusser shop, and a silk tie by Paul Stewart. There was a 20-minute wait at the Stairmaster machine at my health club this morning. I wave to a beggar on the corner of 49th and 8th, then give him the finger. Tonight, the talk centers around Elmore Leonard's new book, which I haven't read. Certain restaurant critics, who I have, the British soundtrack from Les Miserables versus the American cast recording, that new Salvadorian bistro on 2nd and 83rd, and which gossip columns are better written, the Posts or the Newses. It seems that Anne Smiley and I share a mutual acquaintance, a waitress from Abatone's in Aspen, who I raped with a can of hairspray last Christmas when I was skiing there over the holidays. Deck chairs is crowded, ear-splitting. The acoustics lousy because of the high ceilings, and if I'm not mistaken, accompanying the din is a new-age version of White Rabbit, blaring from speakers mounted in the ceiling corners. Someone who looks like Forrest Atwater, slicked back blonde hair, non-prescription redwood-framed glasses, Armani suit with suspenders, is sitting with Carolyn Baker, an investment banker at Drexel, maybe, and she doesn't look too good. She needs more makeup. The Ralph Lauren tweed outfit is too severe. They're at a mediocre table up front by the bar.
"It's called California Classic Cuisine," Anne tells me, leaning in close after we ordered.
The statement deserves a reaction, I suppose, And since Scott and Courtney are discussing the merits of the Post's gossip column, it's up to me to reply. You mean compared to, say, California cuisine? I ask carefully, measuring each word, then lamely add, or post-California cuisine? I mean, I know it sounds so trendy, but there is a world of difference. It's subtle, she says, but it's there. I've heard of post-California cuisine, I say, acutely aware of the design of the restaurant, the exposed pipe and the columns and the open pizza kitchen and the deck chairs. In fact, I've even eaten it. No baby vegetables, scallops in burritos, wasabi crackers. Am I on the right track? And by the way, did anyone ever tell you that you look exactly like Garfield, but run over and skinned and then someone threw an ugly Ferragamo sweater over you before they rushed you to the vet? Fusilli? Olive oil on brie? Exactly, Anne says impressed. Oh, Courtney, where did you find Patrick? He's so knowledgeable about things. I mean, Lewis's idea of California cuisine is half an orange and some gelati. She gushes, then laughs, encouraging me to laugh with her, which I do, hesitantly. For an appetizer, I order radicchio with some kind of free-range squid. Anne and Scott both had the monkfish ragu with violets. Courtney almost fell asleep when she had to exert the energy to read the menu, but before she slid off her chair, I grabbed both shoulders, propping her up. And Anne ordered for her, something simple and light, like Cajun popcorn, perhaps, which wasn't on the menu, but since Anne knows Noj, the chef, he made up a special little batch. Just for Courtney. Scott and Anne insisted that we all order some kind of blackened medium-rare redfish, a deck chair's specialty, which was, luckily for them, an entree on one of the mock menus that Jean made up for me. If it hadn't, and if they nevertheless insisted on my ordering it, the odds were pretty good that after dinner tonight, I would have broken into Scott and Anne's studio at around 2 this morning after late night with David Letterman and with an axe chopped them to pieces, first making Anne watch Scott bleed to death from gaping chest wounds, and then I would have found a way to get to Exeter, where I would pour a bottle of acid all over their son's slanty-eyed zipper-head face. Our waitress is a little hard-body, who is wearing gold, faux-pearl-tasseled lizard slingback pumps. I forgot to return my videotapes to the store tonight, and I curse myself silently while Scott orders 2 large bottles of San Pellegrino. It's called California Classic Cuisine, Scott is telling me. Why don't we all go to Zeus Bar next week? Anne suggests to Scott. You think we'd have a problem getting a table on Friday? Scott is wearing a red and purple and black striped cashmere intarsia sweater from Paul Stewart, baggy Ralph Lauren corduroys and Cole Haan leather moccasins. Well, maybe, he says. That's a good idea. I like it a lot, Anne says, picking up a small violet off her plate and sniffing the flower before placing it carefully on her tongue. She's wearing a red, purple, and black hand-knitted mohair and wool sweater from Koos Vandenacker Couture and slacks from Anne Klein, with suede open-toe pumps. A waiter, though not the hard body, strides over to take another drink order. J&B, straight, I say before anyone else orders. Courtney orders a champagne on the rocks, which secretly appalls me. Oh, she says, as if reminded by something. Can I have that with a twist? A twist of what? I ask irritably, unable to stop myself. Let me guess. Melon? And I'm thinking, oh my God, why didn't you return those goddamn videos, Bateman, you dumb son of a bitch? You mean lemon, miss, the waiter says, giving me an icy stare. Yes, of course, lemon. Courtney nods, seeming lost in some kind of dream, but enjoying it, oblivious to it. I'll have a glass of the, oh gosh, I guess the acacia, Scott says, and then addresses the table. Do I want a white? Do I really want a Chardonnay? We can eat the red fish with a Cabernet. Go for it, Anne says cheerily. Okay, I'll have the... Oh, geez. The Sauvignon Blanc, Scott says. The waiter smiles, confused.
Scotty?
Anne shrieks. The Sauvignon Blanc? Just teasing, he snickers. I'll have the Chardonnay, the acacia.
You complete jerk,
Anne smiles, relieved. You're funny. I'm having the Chardonnay, Scott tells the waiter.
That's nice,
Courtney says, patting Scott's hand. I'll just have... Anne stalls, deliberating. Oh, I'll just have a Diet Coke. Scott looks up from a piece of cornbread he was dipping into a small tin of olive oil. You're not drinking tonight?
No,
Anne says, smiling naughtily. Who knows why? And who fucking cares?
I'm not in the mood.
Not even for a glass of the Chardonnay? Scott asks. How about a Sauvignon Blanc?
I have this aerobics class at 9, she says, slipping, losing control. I really shouldn't.
Well then, I don't want anything, Scott says, disappointed. I mean, I have one at 8, at exclusive. Does anyone want to guess where I won't be tomorrow morning at 8? I ask.
No, honey. I know how much you like the acacia.
Anne reaches out and squeezes Scott's hand. No, babe, I'll stick to the Pellegrino, Scott says, pointing. I'm tapping my fingers very loudly on the tabletop, whispering, shit, 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 to myself. Courtney's eyes are half closed and she's breathing deeply.
Listen, I'll be daring, Anne says finally. I'll have a Diet Coke with rum.
Scott sighs, then smiles, beaming really. Good.
That's caffeine-free Diet Coke, right?
Anne asks the waiter.
You know, I interrupt, you should have it with Diet Pepsi.
It's much better.
Really?
Anne asks.
What do you mean?
You should have the Diet Pepsi instead of the Diet Coke, I say. It's much better. It's fizzier. It has a cleaner taste. It mixes better with rum and has a lower sodium content. The waiter, Scott, Anne, and even Courtney, they all stare at me as if I've offered some kind of diabolical, apocalyptic observation, as if I were shattering a myth highly held, or destroying an oath that was solemnly regarded, and it suddenly seems almost hushed in deck chairs. Last night I rented a movie called Inside Lydia's Ass, and while on 2 Halcyon, and in fact sipping a Diet Pepsi, I watched as Lydia, a totally tan, bleached blonde hard body with a perfect ass and great full tits, while on all fours gave head to this guy with a huge cock, while another gorgeous blonde little hard body with a perfectly trimmed blonde pussy knelt behind Lydia, and after eating her ass out and sucking on her cunt, started to push a long, greased silver vibrator into Lydia's ass and fucked her with it while she continued to eat her pussy, and the guy with the huge cock came all over Lydia's face as she sucked his balls, and then Lydia bucked to an authentic-looking, fairly strong orgasm, and then the girl behind Lydia crawled around and licked the cum from Lydia's face and then made Lydia suck on the vibrator. The new Stephen Bishop came out last Tuesday, and at Tower Records yesterday I bought the compact disc, the cassette, and the album because I wanted to own all 3 formats.
Listen, I say, my voice trembling with emotion. Have whatever you want. But I'm telling you, I recommend the Diet Pepsi.
I look down at my lap, at the blue cloth napkin, the words deck chairs sewn into the napkin's edge, and for a moment think I'm going to cry. My chin trembles and I can't swallow. Courtney reaches over and touches my wrist gently, stroking my Rolex.
It's okay, Patrick. It really is.
A sharp pain near my liver overcomes the surge of emotion, and I sit up in my chair, startled, confused, and the waiter leaves. And then Anne asks if we've seen the recent David Onica exhibit, and I'm feeling calmer. It turns out we haven't seen the show, but I don't want to be tacky enough to bring up the fact I own one,
so I lightly kick Courtney under the table. This raises her out of the lithium-induced stupor, and she says, robotically,
"Patrick owns an Onica. He really does."
I smile, pleased, sip my J&B.
"Oh, that's fantastic, Patrick," Anne says.
"Really? An Onica?" Scott asks. "Isn't he quite expensive?" "Well, let's just say," I sip my drink, suddenly confused.
Say what?
"Nothing." Courtney sighs, anticipating another kick.
"Patrick's cost $20,000.
She seems bored out of her mind, picking at a flat, warm piece of cornbread. I give her a sharp look and try not to hiss. No, Courtney, it was really 50. She slowly looks up from the cornbread she's mashing between her fingers, and even in her lithium haze manages a stare so malicious that it automatically humbles me. But not enough to tell Scott and Anne the truth, that the Onica cost only 12 grand. But Courtney's frightening gaze, though I might be overreacting. She might be staring disapprovingly at the patterns on the columns, the Venetian blinds on the skylight, the Montego vases full of purple tulips lining the bar, scares me enough to not elaborate on the procedure of purchasing an Onica. It's a stare that I can interpret fairly easily. It warns, "Kick me again and no pussy. Do you understand?"
"That seems..."
Anne starts. I hold my breath, my face tight with tension.
"Low,"
she murmurs. I exhale.
"It is, but I got a fabulous deal," I say, gulping.
"But 50,000? Scott asks suspiciously.
"Well, I think his work, it has a kind of wonderfully proportioned, purposefully mock superficial quality." I pause, then, trying to remember a line from a review I saw in New York Magazine. "Purposefully mock.
Doesn't Lewis own one, Courtney?"
Anne asks, and then tapping Courtney's arm.
"Courtney?" "Lewis owns... what?"
Courtney shakes her head, as if to clear it, widening her eyes to make sure they don't close on her.
"Who's Lewis?" Scott asks,
waving to the waitress to have the butter the busboy recently placed on the table removed. What a party animal. Anne answers for Courtney.
"Her boyfriend," she says after seeing Courtney confused, actually looking at me for help.
"Where's he at?" Scott asks.
"Texas," I say quickly. "He's out of town, in Phoenix, I mean."
"No," Scott says. "I meant what house?"
"L.F. Rothschild," Anne says, about to look at Courtney for confirmation, but then at me.
"Right?"
"No, he's at P&P, I say. "We work together, sort of."
"Wasn't he dating Samantha Stevens at one point?" Anne asks.
"No," Courtney says. "That was just a photo someone took of them that was in W." I down my drink as soon as it arrives and wave almost immediately for another, and I'm thinking, Courtney is a babe, but no sex is worth this dinner. The conversation violently shifts while I'm staring across the room at a great-looking woman, blonde, big tits, tight dress, satin pumps with gold cones. When Scott starts telling me about his new compact disc player, while Anne unwittingly prattles on to a stoned and completely oblivious Courtney about new kinds of low-sodium wheat rice cake, fresh fruits, and New Age music, particularly Manhattan Steamroller.
"It's Iowa," Scott's saying. "You've got to hear it. The sound."
He pauses, closes his eyes in ecstasy, chewing on cornbread.
"Is fantastic."
"Well, you know, Scotty, the Iowa is okay." "Oh, holy shit, dream on, Scotty," I'm thinking. "But Sansui is really top of the line." I pause, then add, "I should know. I own one."
"But I thought Iowa was top of the line."
Scott looks worried, but not yet upset enough to please me.
"No way, Scott," I say. "Does Iowa have digital remote control?"
"Yeah," he says.
computer controls?
Uh-huh.
What a complete and total doofus.
Does the system come with a turntable that has a metacrylate and brass platter?
Yes.
The bastard lies. Does your system have an Acophase T-106 tuner?
I ask him.
Sure, he says, shrugging.
Are you sure? I say.
Think carefully.
Yeah, I think so,
he says, but his hand shakes as it reaches for more of the cornbread.
What kind of speakers?
Well, Duntech wood,
he answers too quickly.
So sorry, dude. You've got to have the Infinity IRS-V speakers, I say, or...
Wait a minute, he interrupts.
V speakers? I've never heard of V speakers.
See, that's what I mean, I say.
If you don't have the Vs, you might as well be listening to a goddamn Walkman.
What's the bass response on those speakers?
He asks suspiciously.
An ultra-low 15 hertz, I purr, enunciating each word. That shuts him up for a minute.
Anne drones on about non-fat frozen yogurt and chow-chows. I sit back, satisfied at having stumped Scott, but too quickly he regains his composure and says, "Anyway," trying to act blissfully uncaring that he owns a cheap, shitty stereo.
"We bought the new Phil Collins today. You should hear how great Groovy Kind of Love sounds on it."
"Yeah, I think it's by far the best song he's written," I say, blah, 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 and though it's finally something Scott and I can agree on, the plates of black and red fish appear and they look bizarre, and Courtney excuses herself to the ladies' room, and after 30 minutes, when she hasn't reappeared, I wander into the back of the restaurant and find her asleep in the coat check room. But at her apartment she lies naked on her back. Her legs, tan and aerobicized and muscular and worked out, are spread, and I'm on my knees giving her head while jerking myself off, and in the time since I've started licking and sucking on her pussy, she's already come twice, and her cunt is tight and hot and wet, and I keep it spread open, fingering it with one hand, keeping myself hard with the other. I lift her ass up, wanting to push my tongue into her, but she doesn't want me to, and so I raise up my head and reach over to the portion antique nightstand for the condom that sits in the ashtray from Palio, next to the halogen tensor lamp and the Doro pottery urn, and I tear the package open with two shiny, slick fingers and my teeth, then slip it easily onto my cock.
"I want you to fuck me,"
Courtney moans, pulling her legs back, spreading her vagina even wider, fingering herself, making me suck her fingers. The nails on her hand long and red, and the juice from her cunt glistening in the light, coming from the street lamps through the Stuart Hall Venetian blinds, taste pink and sweet, and she rubs it over my mouth and lips and tongue before it cools.
"Yeah," I say, moving on top of her, sliding my dick gracefully into her cunt,
kissing her on the mouth hard, pushing into her with long, fast strokes, my cock, my hips crazed, moving on their own desirous momentum. Already my orgasm builds from the base of my balls, my asshole, coming up through my cock so stiff that it aches. But then in mid-kiss, I lift my head up, leaving her tongue hanging out of her mouth, starting to lick her own red, swollen lips. And while still humping, but lightly now, I realize there is a problem of sorts, but I cannot think of what it is right now. But then it hits me, while I'm staring at the half-empty bottle of Evian water on the nightstand, and I gasp, "Oh, shit," and pull out.
"What?" Courtney moans. "Did you forget something?"
Without answering, I get up from the futon and stumble into her bathroom, trying to pull off the condom, but it gets stuck halfway. And while easing it off, I accidentally trip over the gen-old scale, while also trying to flip on the light switch, and in the process stubbing my big toe, then cursing, I manage to open the medicine cabinet.
"Patrick, what are you doing?" she calls from the bedroom.
"I'm looking for the water-soluble spermicidal lubricant," I call back. "What do you think I'm doing? Looking for an Advil?"
Oh, my God, she cries out. You didn't have any on?
Courtney, I call back, noticing a small razor nick above my lip. Where is it?
I cannot hear you, Patrick, she calls out.
Lewis has terrible taste in cologne, I mutter, picking up a bottle of Paco Rabanne, sniffing it.
What are you saying? She cries out.
The water-soluble spermicidal lubricant, I shout back, staring into the mirror, searching her counter for a Clinique touch stick to put over the razor nick.
What do you mean, where is it? She calls out. Didn't you have it with you?
Where is the goddamn water-soluble spermicidal lubricant? I scream. Water-soluble spermicidal lubricant!
I'm shouting this while using some of her Clinique cover-up over the blemish, then combing my hair back.
Top shelf, she says, I think.
While looking through the medicine cabinet, I glance over at her tub, noticing how plain it is, which moves me to say, you know, Courtney, you should really get your act together and get your tub marbleized, or maybe add some jacuzzi jets. I call out, can you hear me? Courtney? After a long while, she says,
yes, Patrick, I hear you.
I finally find the tube, behind a huge bottle, a jar, of Xanax on the top shelf of the medicine cabinet, and before my dick totally softens, place a small dab of it inside the tip of the condom, slather it on the latex sheath, and then walk back into the bedroom, jumping onto the futon, causing her to snap.
Patrick, this is not a fucking trampoline.
Ignoring her, I kneel over her body, sliding my cock up into Courtney, and immediately she's pushing her hips up to meet my thrusts. I watch as my cock moves in, then out, then into her vagina with long, fast strokes.
Wait, she gasps.
What? I moan, puzzled, but almost there.
Lewis is a despicable twit,
she gasps, trying to push me out of her.
Yes, I say, leaning on top of her, tonguing her ear. Lewis is a despicable twit. I hate him, too.
And now, spurred on by her disgust for her wimp boyfriend, I start moving faster, my climax approaching.
No, you idiot, she groans. I said, is it a receptacle tip? Not, is Lewis a despicable twit? Is it a receptacle tip? Get off me.
Is what a what? I moan.
Pull out, she groans, struggling.
I'm ignoring you, I say, moving my mouth down on her small perfect nipples, both of them stiff, sitting on hard big tits.
Pull out, goddammit, she screams. What do you want, Courtney?
I grunt, slowing my thrust down until I finally straighten up, and then I'm just kneeling over her, my cock still half inside. She hunches back against the headboard and my dick slides out.
It's a plain end, I point. I think. Turn the light on, she says, trying to sit up. Oh, Jesus, I say. I'm going home. Patrick, she warns, turn on the light.
I reach over and flip on the halogen tensor.
It's a plain end, see?
I say.
So?
Take it off, she says curtly.
Why?
I ask.
Because you have to leave half an inch at the tip, she says, covering her breasts with the Hermes comforter, her voice rising, her patience shot, to catch the force of the ejaculate.
I'm getting out of here, I threaten, but don't move.
Where's your lithium?
She throws a pillow over her head and mumbles something, retreating into a fetal position. I think she's starting to cry.
Where is your lithium, Courtney? I calmly ask again. You must take some.
Something indecipherable is mumbled again, and she shakes her head. No, 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 beneath the pillow.
What?
What did you say? I ask with forced politeness, jerking myself feebly back to an erection.
Where?
Sobs beneath the pillow, barely audible. You are crying now, and though it sounds clearer to me, I still cannot hear a word you're saying.
I try to grab the pillow off her head. Now speak up. Again she mumbles. Again it doesn't make any sense.
Courtney, I warn, getting furious, if you just said what I think you said, that your lithium is in a carton in the freezer next to the frusson glacé and is a sorbet.
I'm screaming this.
If this is really what you said, then I will kill you. Is it a sorbet? Is your lithium really a sorbet?
I scream, finally pulling the pillow from her head and slapping her hard once across the face.
Do you think you're turning me on by having unsafe sex? She screams back.
Oh, Christ, this really isn't worth it, I mutter, pulling the condom down so there is half an inch to spare, a little less, actually.
And see, Courtney? It's there for what, huh? Tell us.
I slap her again, this time lightly.
Why is it pulled down half an inch?
So it can catch the force of the ejaculate.
Well, it's not a turn-on for me.
She's hysterical, racked with tears, choking.
I have a promotion coming to me. I'm going to Barbados in August, and I don't want a case of Kaposi's sarcoma to fuck it up.
She chokes, coughing.
Oh, God, I want to wear a bikini, she wails. A Norma Kamali I just bought at Bergdorf's.
I grab her head and force her to look at the placement of the condom.
See? Happy, you dumb bitch? Are you happy, you dumb bitch?
Without looking at my dick, she sobs.
Oh, God, just get it over with.
And falls back down on the bed. Roughly, I push my cock back into her and bring myself to an orgasm so weak as to be almost non-existent, and my groan of a massive but somewhat expected disappointment is mistaken by Courtney for pleasure, and momentarily spurs her on as she lies sobbing beneath me on the bed, sniffling, to reach down and touch herself. But I start getting soft almost instantly, actually during the moment I came. But if I don't withdraw from her while still erect, she'll freak out, so I hold on to the base of the condom as I literally wilt out of her. After lying there on separate sides of the bed for what might be 20 minutes, with Courtney whimpering about Lewis and antique cutting boards and the sterling silver cheese grater and muffin tin she left at Harry's, she then tries to give me head.
I want to fuck you again, I tell her, but I don't want to wear a condom because I don't feel anything.
And she says calmly, taking her mouth off my limp, shrunken dick, glaring at me,
if you don't use one, you're not going to feel anything anyway.
Business meeting. Jean, my secretary, who is in love with me, walks into my office without buzzing, announcing that I have a very important company meeting to attend at 11. I'm sitting at the Palazzetti glass-top desk, staring into my monitor with my Ray-Bans on, chewing Nuprin, hung over from a Coke binge that started innocently enough last night at Shout with Charles Hamilton, Andrew Spencer, and Chris Stafford, and then moved on to the Princeton Club, progressed to Barcadia, and ended at Nell's around 3:30. And though earlier this morning, while soaking in a bath, sipping a Stoli Bloody Mary after maybe 4 hours of sweaty, dreamless sleep, I realized that there was a meeting. I seem to have forgotten about it on the cab ride downtown. Jean is wearing a red stretch silk jacket, a crocheted rayon ribbon skirt, red suede pumps with satin bows by Susan Bennis Warren Edwards, and gold-plated earrings by Robert Lee Morris. She stands there in front of me, oblivious to my pain, a file in her hand. After pretending to ignore her for close to a minute, I finally lower my sunglasses and clear my throat.
Yes? Something else? Jean?
Mr. Grouchy today?
She smiles, placing the file timidly on my desk, and stands there expecting me to, what, amuse her with vignettes from last night?
Yes, you simpleton. I am Mr. Grouchy today, I hiss, grabbing the file and shoving it in the top desk drawer.
She stares at me, uncomprehending, then, actually looking crestfallen, says,
Ted Madison called, and so did James Baker.
They want to meet you at Flutie's at 6.
I sigh, glaring at her. Well, what should you do?
She laughs nervously, standing there, her eyes wide.
I'm not sure.
Jean, I stand up to lead her out of the office. What do you say? It takes her a little while, but finally, frightened, she guesses.
Just say no.
Just say no. I nod, pushing her out and slamming the door. Before leaving my office for the meeting, I take 2 Valium, wash them down with a Perrier, and then use a scruffing cleanser on my face with pre-moistened cotton balls, afterwards applying a moisturizer. I'm wearing a wool tweed suit and a striped cotton shirt, both by Yves Saint Laurent, and a silk tie by Armani, and new black cap-toed shoes by Ferragamo. I plax, then brush my teeth, and when I blow my nose, thick, ropey strings of blood and snot stain a $45 handkerchief from Hermes that unfortunately wasn't a gift. But I've been drinking close to 20 liters of Evian water a day, and going to the tanning salon regularly, and one night of binging hasn't affected my skin's smoothness or color tone. My complexion is still excellent. 3 drops of Visine clear the eyes. An ice pack tightens the skin. All it comes down to is, I feel like shit, but look great. I'm also the first to make it to the boardroom. Louis Carruthers follows like a puppy dog at my heels, a close second, and takes the seat next to mine, which means I'm supposed to take off my Walkman. He's wearing a wool plaid sports jacket, wool slacks, a Hugo Boss cotton shirt, and paisley tie. Slacks, I'm guessing, from Brooks Brothers. He starts rattling on about a restaurant in Phoenix, Profiteers, that I'm actually interested in hearing about, but not from Louis Carruthers. Yet I'm on 10 milligrams of Valium, and for that reason I can manage. On the Patty Winters show this morning were descendants of members of the Donner Party. The clients were total hicks, predictably, Louis is saying. They wanted to take me to a local production of Les Mis, which I already saw in London, but... Did you have any trouble getting reservations at Profiteers? I ask, cutting him off.
No, not at all, he says. We ate late.
And what did you order? I ask.
I had the poached oysters, the lot, and the walnut tart.
I hear the lot is good there, I murmur, lost in thought.
The client had the boudin blanc, the roasted chicken, and the cheesecake, he says.
Cheesecake, I say, confused by this plain, alien-sounding list. What sauce or fruits were on the roasted chicken? What shapes was it cut into?
None, Patrick, he says, also confused. It was roasted.
And the cheesecake? What flavor was it heated, I say? Ricotta cheesecake? Goat cheese? Were there flowers or cilantro in it?
It was just regular, he says, and then, Patrick, you're sweating.
What did she have? I ask, ignoring him. The client's bimbo.
Well, she had the country salad, the scallops, and the lemon tart, Louis says.
The scallops were grilled? Were they sashimi scallops? In a ceviche of sorts, I'm asking, or were they gratinized?
No, Patrick, Louis says. They were broiled.
It's silent in the boardroom as I contemplate this, thinking it through, before asking finally,
What's broiled, Louis?
I'm not sure, he says. I think it involves a pan.
Wine? I ask.
An 85 Sauvignon Blanc, he says.
Jordan, 2 bottles.
Car, I ask. Did you rent well in Phoenix?
BMW, he smiles. Little black Beamer.
Hip, I murmur, remembering last night how I lost it completely in a stall at Nell's, my mouth foaming. All I could think about were insects, lots of insects, and running at pigeons. Foaming at the mouth and running at pigeons.
Phoenix. Janet Leigh was from Phoenix.
I stall, then continue. She got stabbed in the shower. Disappointing scene. I pause. Blood looked fake.
Listen, Patrick, Lewis says, pressing his handkerchief into my hand.
My fingers clenched into a fist that relaxes at Lewis's touch.
Dibble and I are having lunch next week at the Yale Club. Would you like to join us?
Sure. I think about Courtney's legs, spread and wrapped around my face. And when I look over at Lewis in one brief flashing moment, his head looks like a talking vagina, and it scares the bejesus out of me. Moves me to say something while mopping the sweat off my brow.
That's a nice suit, Lewis.
The farthest thing from my mind. He looks down as if stunned, and then blushing, embarrassed, he touches his own lapel.
Thanks, Pat. You look great, too, as usual.
And when he reaches out to touch my tie, I catch his hand before his fingers make it, telling him,
Your compliment was sufficient.
Reed Thompson walks in, wearing a wool plaid four-button double-breasted suit and a striped cotton shirt and a silk tie, all Armani, plus slightly tacky blue cotton socks by Interwoven, and black Ferragamo cap-toe shoes that look exactly like mine, with a copy of the Wall Street Journal held in a nicely manicured fist, and a Bill Kaiserman tweed Balmacan overcoat, draped casually across the other arm. He nods and sits across from us at the table. Soon after, Todd Broderick walks in wearing a wool chalk-striped six-button double-breasted suit and a striped broadcloth shirt and silk tie, all by Polo, plus an affected linen pocket square that I'm fairly sure is also by Polo. McDermott walks in next, carrying a copy of this week's New York Magazine and this morning's Financial Times, wearing new, non-prescription Oliver Peoples redwood-framed glasses, a black-and-white wool houndstooth check single-breasted suit with notch lapels, a striped cotton dress shirt with spread collar, and a silk paisley tie, all of it designed and tailored by John Rail. I smile, raising my eyebrows at McDermott, who sullenly takes the seat next to mine. He sighs and opens the newspaper, silently reading. Since he hasn't offered a hello or good morning, I can tell that he's pissed off, and I suspect that it has something to do with me. Finally, sensing that Lewis is about to ask something, I turn to McDermott.
So, McDermott, what's wrong?
I smirk. Long line at the Stairmaster this morning.
Who said anything's wrong?
He asks, sniffing, turning pages in the Financial Times.
Listen, I tell him, leaning in. I already apologized about yelling at you because of the pizza at Pastel's the other night. Who said it was about that?
He asks tensely.
I thought we already cleared this up, I whisper, gripping the arm of his chair, smiling over at Thompson. I'm sorry I insulted the pizzas at Pastel's. Happy? Who said it's about that?
He asks again.
Then, what is it, McDermott?
I whisper, noticing movement behind me. I count to three, then whirl around, catching Lewis leaning toward me, trying to eavesdrop. He knows he's been caught, and he sinks slowly back into his chair, guilty.
McDermott, this is ridiculous, I whisper.
You can't stay angry at me because I think the pizza at Pastel's is crusty.
Brittle, he says, shooting me a glance. The word you used was brittle.
I apologize, I say, but I'm right. It is. You read the review in the Times, right?
Here.
He reaches into his pocket and hands me a Xeroxed article.
I just wanted to prove you wrong. Read this.
What is it? I ask, opening the folded page.
It's an article on your hero, Donald Trump,
McDermott grins. It sure is, I say apprehensively. Why didn't I ever see this, I wonder?
And?
McDermott scans the article and points an accusatory finger at the bottom paragraph, which he's highlighted in red ink.
Where does Donald Trump think the best pizza in Manhattan is served?
Let me read this, I sigh, waving him away. You might be wrong. What a lousy photo.
Bateman, look.
I circled it, he says.
I pretend to read the fucking article, but I'm getting very angry, and I have to hand the article back to McDermott and ask, thoroughly annoyed, so what? What does it mean? What are you, McDermott, trying to tell me?
What do you think of the pizza at Pastel's now, Bateman?
He asks smugly. Well, I say, choosing my words carefully, I think I have to go back and retaste the pizza. I'm saying this through gritted teeth. I'm just suggesting that the last time I was there, the pizza was...
brittle,
McDermott offers. Yeah, I shrug. Brittle.
Uh-huh,
McDermott smiles, triumphant. Listen, if the pizza at Pastel's is okay with Donnie, I start, hating to admit this to McDermott, then sighing, almost unintelligibly, it's okay with me. McDermott cackles, gleefully, a victor. I count 3 silk crepe ties, 1 Versace silk satin woven tie, 2 silk foulard ties, 1 silk Kenzo, 2 silk jacquard ties. The fragrances of Xerius and Tuscany and Armani and Obsession and Polo and gray flannel and even Antius mingle, wafting into each other, rising from the suits and into the air, forming their own mixture, a cold, sickening perfume. But I'm not apologizing, I warn McDermott.
You already have, Bateman, he says.
Paul Owen walks in, wearing a cashmere one-button sports jacket, tropical wool flannel slacks, a button-down tab-collared shirt by Rinaldus Shamisk, but it's really the tie, blue and black and red and yellow bold stripes from Andrew Feza by Zanzara that impresses me. Carruthers gets excited, too, and he leans into my chair and asks if I'm listening correctly.
Do you think he has a power jock strap to go along with that thing?
When I don't answer, he retreats, opens one of the Sports Illustrateds that sit in the middle of the table, and, humming to himself, starts to read an article on Olympic divers. Hello, Halberstam, Owen says, walking by. Hello, Owen, I say, admiring the way he's styled and slicked back his hair, with a part so even and sharp it devastates me. And I make a mental note to ask him where he purchases his hair care products, which kind of mousse he uses. My final guess after mulling over the possibilities being 10X. Greg McBride walks in and stops by my chair.
Did you watch the winner's show this morning?
Riot. Total riot. And we give each other high five before he takes a seat between Dibble and Lloyd. God knows where they came from. Kevin Forrest, who walks in with Charles Murphy, is saying, my call waiting is busted. Felicia screwed it up somehow. I'm not even paying attention to what they're wearing, but I find myself staring at Murphy's vintage owl cufflinks with blue crystal eyes. Video Store, then D'Agostino's. I'm wandering around Video Visions, the video rental store near my apartment on the Upper West Side, sipping from a can of Diet Pepsi, the new Christopher Cross tape blaring from the earphones of my Sony Walkman. After the office, I played racquetball with Montgomery, then had a shiatsu massage and met Jesse Lloyd, Jamie Conway, and Kevin Forrest for drinks at Rusty's on 73rd Street. Tonight I'm wearing a new wool topcoat by Ungaro Uomo Paris and carrying a Bottega Veneta briefcase and an umbrella by Georges Gaspar. The video store is more crowded than usual. There are too many couples in line for me to rent She Male Reformatory or Ginger's Cunt without some sense of awkwardness or discomfort. Plus, I've already bumped into Robert Ailes from First Boston in the horror aisle, or at least I think it was Robert Ailes. He mumbled, "Hello, McDonald," as he passed me by, holding Friday the 13th, Part 7, and a documentary on abortions, in what I noticed were nicely manicured hands, marred only by what looked to me like an imitation gold Rolex. Since pornography seems out of the question, I browse through light comedy, and feeling ripped off, settle for a Woody Allen movie, but I'm still not satisfied. I want something else. I pass through the rock musical section. Nothing.
then find myself in horror comedy, ditto, and suddenly I'm seized by a minor anxiety attack. There are too many fucking movies to choose from. I duck behind a promotional cardboard display for the new Dan Aykroyd comedy and take 2 5-milligram Valiums, washing them down with the Diet Pepsi. Then, almost by rote, as if I've been programmed, I reach for Body Double, a movie I have rented 37 times, and walk up to the counter where I wait for 20 minutes to be checked out by a dumpy girl, 5 pounds overweight, dry, frizzy hair. She's actually wearing a baggy, nondescript sweater, definitely not designer, probably to hide the fact that she has no tits. And even though she has nice eyes, so fucking what? Finally, it's my turn. I hand her the empty boxes. "Is this it?" she asks, taking my membership card from me. I'm wearing Mario Valentino Persian black gloves. My Video Visions membership costs only $250 annually. "Do you have any Jamie Gertz movies?" I ask her, trying to make direct eye contact. "What?" she asks, distracted. "Any movies that Jamie Gertz is in." "Who?" She enters something into the computer and then says without looking at me, "How many nights?" "3, I say. "Don't you know who Jamie Gertz is?" "I don't think so." She actually sighs. "Jamie Gertz," I say. "She's an actress." "I don't think I know who you mean," she says in a tone that suggests I'm harassing her. But hey, she works in a video rental store, and since it's such a demanding, high-powered profession, her bitchy behavior is completely reasonable, right? The things I could do to this girl's body with a hammer. The words I could carve into her with an ice pick. She hands the guy behind her my boxes, and I pretend to ignore his horrified reaction as he recognizes me after he looks at the Body Double box. But he dutifully walks into some kind of vault in the back of the store to get the movies. "Yeah, sure you do," I say good-naturedly. "She's in those Diet Coke commercials. You know the ones." "I really don't think so," she says in a monotone that almost cuts me off. She types the names of the movies and then my membership number into the computer. "I like the part in Body Double where the woman gets drilled by the power driller in the movie. The best," I say, almost gasping. It seems very hot in the video store right now. All of a sudden, and after murmuring, "Oh my God," under my breath, I place a gloved hand on the counter to settle it from shaking. And the blood starts pouring out of the ceiling. I take a deep breath, and while I'm saying this, my head starts nodding of its own accord, and I keep swallowing, thinking, I have to see her shoes. And so, as inconspicuously as possible, I try to peer over the counter to check out what kind of shoes she's wearing, but maddeningly, they're only sneakers. Not K-Swiss, not Treetorn, not Adidas, not Reebok. Just cheap ones. "Sign here." She hands me the tapes without even looking at me, refusing to recognize who I am. And breathing in hard and exhaling, she motions for the next in line, a couple with a baby. On the way back to my apartment, I stop at D'Agostino's, where for dinner I buy 2 large bottles of Perrier, a 6-pack of Coke Classic, a head of arugula, 5 medium-sized kiwis, a bottle of tarragon balsamic vinegar, a tin of creme fraiche, a carton of microwave tapas, a box of tofu, and a white chocolate candy bar I pick up at the checkout counter. Once outside, ignoring the bum lounging below the Les Miserables poster and holding a sign that reads, "I've lost my job, I am hungry, I have no money, please help," whose eyes tear after I pull the tease-the-bum-with-a-dollar trick and tell him, "Jesus, will you get a fucking shave, please?" My eyes almost like they were guided by radar. Focus in on a red Lamborghini Countach parked at the curb, gleaming beneath the street lamps, and I have to stop moving, the Valium shockingly, unexpectedly kicking in. Everything else becomes obliterated. The crying bum, the black kids on crack rapping along to the blaring beatbox,
the clouds of pigeons flying overhead looking for space to roost, the ambulance sirens, the honking taxis, the decent-looking babe in the Betsy Johnson dress. All of that fades, and in what seems like time-lapse photography, but in slow motion like a movie, the sun goes down. The city gets darker, and all I can see is the red Lamborghini, and all I can hear is my own, even, steady panting. I'm still standing, drooling, in front of the store, staring, minutes later. I don't know how many. Facial. I leave the office at 4:30, head up to Exclusive where I work out with free weights for an hour, then taxi across the park to Gio's in the Pierre Hotel for a facial, a manicure, and if time permits, a pedicure. I'm lying on the elevated table in one of the private rooms, waiting for Helga, the skin technician, to facialize me. My Brooks Brothers shirt and Garrick Anderson suit hang in the closet. My 8 Estoni loafers sit on the floor, $30 socks from Barney's balled up in them. $60 boxer shorts from Comme des Garçons are the only article of clothing I'm still wearing. The smock I'm supposed to have on is crumpled next to the shower stall, since I want Helga to check my body out. Notice my chest, see how fucking buff my abdominals have gotten since the last time I was here. Even though she's much older than I am, maybe 30 or 35, and there's no way I'd ever fuck her. I'm sipping a Diet Pepsi that Mario, the valet, brought me, with crushed ice in a glass on the side that I asked for but don't want. I pick up today's post that hangs from a Smithley Watson glass magazine rack and scan the gossip columns. Then my eye catches a story about recent sightings of these creatures that seem to be part bird, part rodent, essentially pigeons with the heads and tails of rats, found deep in the center of Harlem, and now making their way steadily toward Midtown. A grainy photograph of one of these things accompanies the article, but experts, the Post assures us, are fairly certain this new breed is a hoax. As usual, this fails to soothe my fear, and it fills me with a nameless dread that someone out there has wasted the energy and time to think this up, to fake a photograph, and do a half-assed job at that, the thing looks like a fucking Big Mac, and send the photograph into the Post. Then for the Post to decide to run the story. Meetings, debates, last-minute temptations to cancel the whole thing. To print the photograph. To have someone write about the photo and interview the experts. Finally, to run this story on page 3 in today's edition and have it discussed over hundreds of thousands of lunches in the city this afternoon. I close the paper and lie back, exhausted. The door to the private room opens, and a girl I haven't seen before walks in, and through half-closed eyes I can see that she's young, Italian, okay-looking. She smiles, sitting in a chair at my feet, and begins the pedicure. She switches off the ceiling light, and except for strategically placed halogen bulbs shining down on my feet, hands, and face, the room darkens, making it impossible to tell what kind of body she has. Only that she's wearing gray suede and black leather-buttoned ankle boots by Maud Frison. The Patty Winters show this morning was about UFOs that kill. Helga arrives.
Ah, Mr. Bateman, Helga says. How are you?
Very good, Helga, I say, flexing the muscles in my stomach and chest. My eyes are closed, so it looks casual, as if the muscles are acting on their own accord, and I can't help it. But Helga drapes the smock gently across my heaving chest and buttons it up, pretending to ignore the undulations beneath the tan, clean skin.
You're back so soon, she says.
I was only here 2 days ago, I say, confused.
I know, but...
She stalls, washing her hands in the sink.
Never mind.
Helga, I ask.
Yes, Mr. Bateman.
Walking in here, I spotted a pair of men's gold-tasseled loafers from Bergdorf Goodman waiting to be shined outside the door of the next room. Who do they belong to? I ask.
That's Mr. Erlinger, she says.
Mr. Erlinger from Lehman's?
No, Mr. Erlinger from Solomon Brothers, she says.
Did I ever tell you that I want to wear a big yellow smiley face mask? And then put on the CD version of Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy, and then take a girl and a dog, a collie, a chow, a Shar-Pei, doesn't really matter,
and then hook up this transfusion pump, this IV set, and switch their blood, you know? Pump the dog's blood into the hard body and vice versa. Did I ever tell you this? While I'm speaking, I can hear the girl working on my feet, humming one of the songs from Les Miserables to herself, and then Helga runs a moistened cotton ball across my nose, leaning close to the face, inspecting the pores. I laugh maniacally, then take a deep breath and touch my chest, expecting a heart to be thumping quickly, impatiently, but there's nothing there, not even a beat. "Shh, Mr. Bateman," Helga says, running a warm loofah sponge over my face, which stings, then cools the skin. "Relax." "Okay," I say, "I'm relaxing." "Oh, Mr. Bateman," Helga croons,